Caucus. Okay, call to order the committee, House Committee on Business and Labor for March 1st, 2013. Okay, we have quite a few bills to hear today, and they're going to be a little bit out of order. First one we're going to do is 2683, and then we're going to do 2698, then 2847, 2545, and end with 2379 and 2383. Okay, so I'll open the public hearing for House Bill 2683. Jan, if you could read the summary.
Madam Chair, committee members, this bill authorizes the employer to pay wages through direct deposit or by other means of electronic transfer, and there are no amendments before you.
Okay, thank you. Can we call up J.O. Wilson, Jan Meekum, and Scott Winkles?
Madam Chair, members, for the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing Associated Oregon Industries on House Bill 2683. This is our proposal, which we would say has been a long time coming. We've introduced the bill because direct deposit is now a commonly accepted form of payment, and it's kind of hit that critical mass where we think it should be in statute at the employer discretion to be able to use that method of payment. Current law basically reads that to use direct deposit must be an agreement between employer and employee. 2683, I want to be very clear, puts this method of payment at employer discretion. There is a similar bill in the House. I'm blanking, but you're on the committee, Madam Chair.
Consumer protection.
Consumer protection.
Thank you.
That effectively does the same thing for state government, and the testimony was is that there's parallel payment systems. That you have 89% of state employees on direct deposit. You have 11% being issued paper checks, and a similar trend exists in the private sector. It's simply inefficient to pay one large segment with direct deposit and then have to set up a parallel payroll system to issue paper checks for a small subset of your workforce. So it's an efficiency piece for employers. It's a cost effective for employers. The cost differences in issuing a paper check versus an electronic transmission of wages. NFIB has, you have a study, Jan, you might allude to, so I won't steal your thunder, but SHRM, the Society of Human Resource Managers, estimates that, you know, it's $2 to cut a paper check, 35 cents to do an electronic deposit. So there's a cost savings to employers. But I would say that the biggest reason is final paycheck issues for employers. This is, I'd say this motivates us more than anything because of the timelines that have to be met on final paycheck issues. You also have, if you've terminated an employee who's been a disruption to the in the workplace or perhaps harassed another employee, and you have to, you don't know where to find them, and then you have to bring them back on your premises to issue a final paycheck. It's just a far easier process to do a direct deposit and just skip that disruption altogether. So we think there are a number of reasons to support this, but really our motivation in terms of where our priorities, final paycheck issues, getting timely last paychecks is probably the biggest benefit to business, and I would say the biggest benefit to workers as well. So that is the impetus for 2683, and I appreciate your consideration.
Good morning, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. My name is Jan Meekums, the State Director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. We have about 7,500 small business members in the state of Oregon, and we also support this bill for all of the reasons that were mentioned by JL and AOI. For our small businesses, as we all know, they are very busy people. They are overworked, many of them. They're understaffed. They do not have an HR department. And this streamlines the process. It unburdens some of the burdensome paperwork that they have to deal with on a daily basis. And the cutting of the check, the final check, has already been mentioned, is a very critical point. And so without taking up more of your time, because you have a busy morning. I just want to go on the record that NFIB supports this bill, HB 2683. Thank you.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm appearing in favor of House Bill 2683. From the city perspective, we do support this legislation because we have a large lot of seasonal workers. A lot of them are young people. They haven't quite figured out how to manage their financial affairs yet, and what's been happening lately, what happens frequently is that they'll lose their checks, they become embarrassed, they don't want to say anything to their boss, but we want to pay them. And so being able to pay them electronically would alleviate that issue and save a tremendous bookkeeping conundrum that many of my members find themselves come September when checks have not been deposited and they really should have been. So we do support this legislation.
Are there any questions for the panel? Senator Thatcher?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we do serve on the same committee, the Consumer and Business Protection. And I mentioned when the cities and counties got up to testify, which my takeaway from the whole testimony was to allow for electronic pay stubs to be sent also, because it's actually kind of burdensome to actually have to, I mean, if you're mailing a check, you might as well mail a pay stub, and then plus we're having to pay a charge for the direct deposit, so it actually costs us more. And so, you know, having the option of being able to, send an electronic stub, whatever the rules that surround that, would you be open to something like that so you can send the stub electronically as well instead of having to chase them down with a piece of paper?
Because even with us, I mean, I have my paycheck electronically deposited, but I get the paycheck stub in the mail. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Thatcher. We're not changing that area of this statute, so obviously a wage statement would still be given to the employee. I suppose there's nothing that would preclude an employer from electronically transmitting the wage statement. Bowley might be the better person to ask on that particular issue, though.
Madam Chair, it's my understanding that the law is being changed for the city so to allow them to do that, and I was saying, well, I would bet private employers would like to partake of that opportunity as well, so I'm imagining that the statute would have to be changed to allow that, and that's why I'm asking if you would be open to such an amendment.
Thank you. The answer is yes.
We would not have an objection.
Okay. From what I understand, this might be addressed later on.
Sure. Okay. Thank you.
And then other questions? Now, I do have questions about, I mean, a direct deposit into a checking account is easy to, or a savings account is easy to do. But if you don't have a checking account or a savings account, I assume you give like a debit card. And reading this, it's like if you take the whole thing out, there would be no fee. But if I have a debit card and I take something out for groceries and then I, you know, go to pay my rent, and this, are there going to be fees attached to those transactions also, or...
Thank you, and I think that's a thank you, Chair Doherty. I think that's a question that Sybil will come up and ask behind us. And there's the intention is not to incur fees in those situations, but if we need to make that clear, then we should make it clearer.
Thank
but
you.
That is certainly the intention.
Okay. Any other questions, Mr. Holby?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, going back to the pay stub issue, and I know that's not technically part of the bill, but I think it's pertinent. So I'm just curious, if we go to the ability to send the pay stubs electronically, do you see that as being an optional thing for the employee? Because some employees probably won't all have access to internet. So, I mean, would it make sense to be able to have an employee elect also, or to have it sent paper if they can't receive it electronically?
Thank you, Chair Doherty and Representative Holy. I'm just speculating here, but I would assume that it would set up a situation like an AOI. The pay stub would come to my inbox at work, and I know that there's people who work on the factory floor or whatever that might not have those setups. I'm guessing that it, at the employer discretion, the employer has an obligation to provide a wage statement,
mm-hmm.
whether it's paper or electronic. We don't contemplate that in the bill to the effect that we do, I assume, at the employer discretion. The employer has to follow the law.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I'm spinning around in circles.
Maybe one step at a time, yeah. Moving into the 21st century. So. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. The next people we have signed up, Elizabeth Kushwa and Sybil Heeb.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa. I'm the Legislative Director for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. BOLI is supportive of the bill because we do understand, especially these final paycheck issues, can be important. However, I want to make sure that the ability for the employee to access their wages without cost is extremely important to BOLI. The responsibility for the employer to pay wages in a timely basis is going to continue to be vital. And the ability for the employee to receive wage statements that report how their pay is calculated and itemizing those deductions are important. Going to Chair, Representative Holby, sorry about that, I just elevated you. Going to your point, I think that when we get that far, the idea of making that particular part optional makes a whole lot of sense for people who don't have the ability to access them electronically. But as long as those basic provisions of law are currently met under this bill, BOLI is supportive.
Okay, thank you. Sybil?
Thank you. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center. We are also in support of the basic concept of the bill and particularly the direct deposit portions of the bill. We do have a couple of concerns related to the provisions that address payment by electronic debit card. And I think there are ways that our concerns could be resolved around parameters related to that provision. But we've expressed some of those concerns to Mr. Wilson, and I think we could have some productive conversations. Our concerns arise from the perspective of low-income clients of ours who are often temporary, low-wage workers, may not have bank accounts and may not have electronic email accounts or access to the Internet on a regular basis. And so for those folks, and often there are language barriers for this population as well. And so receiving a paycheck, for example, from a series of temporary employers over a series of temporary jobs, you may collect a number of different electronic debit cards. Each of them may have a different means of accessing that the funds available through a different PIN number, or it's important to make sure that the employee has information that the employee can understand that allows them to access the money from the card. It's also really important that the cards are accepted widely, and I don't know what goes into the contract that the employer would come to terms with the card issuer. You'd want to make sure that it was a card that could be used in an area surrounding the employer where the employee would be likely to need to access those dollars. So you just don't want any barriers there. Also, I think it would be important to make sure that it was a nationwide card. Especially if you're working on in Ontario, for example, you may be in Idaho, you may be in Oregon. You'd want to make sure your card could be used both places. The other issue that I just wanted to flag, we agree that the pay stub is important. It sounds like there's complete clarity there. And maybe in the issuance of a pay stub could also be the place where you would issue the directions to the employee about how it is you can access the benefits that are on the card. And we'd want to make sure that that was written in simple language that the employee could understand. The other thing that I just realized because of a comment that Ms. Kushwa made is that my paycheck comes and it has dollars and cents. And I don't know how an ATM card would handle the non-whole dollar amounts of a paycheck. And so it would be important to make sure that you got your full paycheck out of the card. I guess the other issue that I wanted to flag is that if you have an employer who is paying consistently via use of a card, there ought to be procedures in place about what to do if the card is lost and what the reissuance procedures are to make sure that the employee doesn't have a barrier to receiving a paycheck. I think that is it, and we would be really happy to work with folks and try to come up with some sidebars to make sure that that piece works.
Thank you. One other thing you may want to, in your discussions, I know that I think everyone's agreed with the concept of doing this, is one other thing, just because I've seen the use of debit cards before, is knowing what your account balance is.
Mm-hmm.
because sometimes to get an account balance, you have to go online to find out what it is. So that might be also something to put in the kind of to-do list.
That's a great point, Chair Daugherty and members of the committee. I appreciate that. And I guess I would go back to that this particular piece of the bill is changing what the current law is, which is right now an employer may come to an agreement with an employee that they may pay via electronic debit card. And we actually do appreciate that perspective and part of the current law, because I think that all of these questions that we've just identified are relatively complex, and you just want to make sure that the employee understands what they're what they need to do in order to get the money that they've earned. And so I guess I think that piece around employee choice and informed choice is really a pretty critical one.
Thank you very much. Any questions of the panel? Okay, thank you very much.
You.
Okay, we have one other speaker, John Molis, please.
Good morning, Chair Daugherty, members of the committee. John Molis with the Oregon State Building Trades Council. The one concern that we have with this legislation, and I just spoke with Mr. Wilson, is in the construction industry and almost all of our collective bargaining agreements, it allows for electronic deposit or a paycheck depending on what the employee, individual employee and the employer work out. And so Mr. Wilson said he would be willing to work with me for an amendment that would exclude CBAs from this language, because we don't want that to interfere. Some of our workers, especially in the specialized industries like refractory, might be working on a mill in Albany one week and up in the Puget Sound the next week and back someplace in the Midwest a month later. So anyway, I feel we can work with him and get that taken care of, but I just wanted to go on the record. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Any questions? Okay, it looks like this is a bill that when the parties get together, we will deal with some of these questions, especially with the electronic transfer or the debit cards. So I appreciate you guys working on this. Okay, seeing nobody else come forward, I close the public hearing on House Bill 2683. And I open the public hearing on House Bill 2698. Jan, if you could summarize the bill, please.
Yeah, Madam Chair and committee members, this bill clarifies the authority of the Director of the Department of Consumer Business Services to appoint building inspectors in multiple specialty codes, and it allows the Director to appoint the building inspector to perform inspections throughout a geographic region. There are no amendments before you.
Okay, thank you. For testimony, I'd like to call up Mark Long, Gil Riddell, and Don Miner, please. First panel. Gentlemen.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Long. I'm the Administrator of State Building Codes for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Just real briefly, what we do is we set the standards for construction codes in the state of Oregon. We set a uniform standard that is carried out by 130 different cities and counties throughout Oregon. We also certify the inspectors, which is what this bill is about. Under current law, we typically certify inspectors in very specific disciplines, electrical, plumbing, structural, mechanical, etc. This bill, House Bill 2698, is an extension of work that we did in 2009 through this committee. That bill was House Bill 3462. It passed out of the House 54-0. What this bill does is allows us to customize inspector training programs so that I can cross-train inspectors to work in more than one area. This is especially helpful in rural areas, residential construction, in areas where we have, if you will, simple construction types where we can take an inspector and train them to perform multiple tasks. What we learned during the pilot period between 2009 and where we're at today is that we need to have a greater focus on the regional side, where we can customize our approach based on a particular county or particular need in a region. And that's what this bill does. It does three things. It extends the work that we did in 2009. It allows us to continue to authorize and provide custom training programs on these specialized inspectors, really looking at the skill sets and what are the needs of the industry. And then the third thing is to recognize regional areas and work on custom flexible approaches in those particular areas. With that, I'll conclude my comments, and I know that other folks have comments, and maybe I can ask questions at the end.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. AOC supports this bill for all the reasons stated by Mark Long. We like the fact that it will offer multiple choices for government entities, hiring building inspectors, and that there's cross-training that will be customized to rural areas. And overall, we believe it will reduce the cost of government. It's a win for everybody.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association. We support the bill for the reasons Mark's stated and for our own reasons. Manufacturers historically have built homes in factories on assembly lines to federal building standards, and those homes have been inspected by the Building Codes Division using a single individual who inspects the structural, mechanical, plumbing, electrical systems to ensure that they comply with federal law. But with the housing downturn, manufacturers have been forced to diversify their production. So they're now building, in addition to manufactured homes, prefabricated structures or modular homes, if you will, for Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Nebraska, North Dakota, Canada. And all these products can be on the assembly line at the same time. And the person who inspects the manufactured home can't inspect the modular home. With the modular home, there needs to be a plumbing inspector, a structural inspector, a mechanical, etc. Mm-hmm. And coordinating that for the manufacturers has been extremely difficult. Now, Mr. Long has developed a rule that will streamline that process for modular homes staying in Oregon, but that doesn't help with the ones leaving Oregon. We would like to see this. The agency have the ability to cross-certify a person to do all of those disciplines on simple residential modular buildings. If you look to the future, I don't see the industry getting back to just straight production of manufactured homes anytime soon, so we need this. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Yeah, thank you. Do you have any questions for the panel? If seen none, thank you very much. Okay, the next panel, Bill Cross, Warren Jackson, and Daryl Fuller. This must be Jeans Friday. Is this Jeans Friday?
Kids up or down?
No one told me.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of both the Oregon Mechanical Officials Association and the Commercial Building Owners and Managers Association. And we're very supportive of the bill. We've worked with the division on the specialized inspector program for a lot of jurisdictions. With the decline in construction the last 5 years, we've probably looked at layoffs of 50% throughout the state of certified inspectors. So having a specialized inspector that can do multiple inspections, look at multiple areas of construction, has really helped facilitate a better service and more cost efficiencies for jurisdictions, which helps the building owners as well as the construction industry. So we've enjoyed the program and would like to ask you to move the sunset so it can continue to evolve and help us get the service we'd like to have.
Okay, thank you. Next.
Chair Doherty and members of the committee. For the record, Warren Jackson, representing Marion County. I am currently the building official for Marion County. We are in favor of this legislation. Marion County has benefited from the specialized inspector certifications. Sorry. We've had several members of our staff complete programs, attend the training sessions, complete the field work, the testing, and actually become certified. We see quite a benefit to this program. We're always looking for ways to operate more efficiently. This is one of those tools that allows us to do that. Because we are fee supported and our fees are dedicated to supporting the program and paying for our operating costs, you know, ultimately, the more efficient we are, the cheaper our permit fees can be. We have many individuals who come from the trades and have held specialized licenses to do electrical or plumbing work. I think this provides an opportunity for the state to also provide certifications that mirror that experience that they have. We have people who have been doing that work for decades who can't do the inspections for the same type of stuff that they did day in, day out for years and years. So this really has been a benefit for us to operate more efficiently. It also benefits our customers. When we're always trying to route our inspectors efficiently. We cover the entire county, and oftentimes we have to go to Detroit or Idana, and our office is here in Salem. So when we can send one inspector to a job in Detroit that used to take two or even three inspectors, it not only saves us time, but it also makes it more convenient for that homeowner that might be staying home to provide access for that inspector. Because it's impossible, or I would say nearly impossible, for us to coordinate our inspectors to show up on a job site at the same time. If we have one inspector, it's less intrusive, more convenient for that customer who's waiting for our inspector instead of waiting for the two or three that we did in the past. I thank you for this opportunity to testify. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Thank you. Mr. Fuller.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Association of Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors. A group of lay people from my church have spent the last 10 days in Honduras helping to build a church there. The building standards there are different than the building standards here, which actually has nothing to do with my testimony. They arrived after midnight last night. I drew the short straw and had to take the church bus up to Portland and pick them up and bring them home. So I got to bed about 3 o'clock this morning, and in my rush to get here this morning to testify, I left my riveting and very cogent testimony at home. And so with that in mind, I'll simply say on behalf of the plumbing, heating, and cooling industry, it's a good bill and it should pass. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. But did you talk to the building inspectors in Honduras? I don't think they're around. Okay, any questions for the panel? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we have no one else signed up. Do we have anybody else to speak on House Bill 2698? Okay, seeing none, I close the public hearing on House Bill 2698 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2847.
Madam Chair and committee members, this bill extends a deadline for submitting the last best offer from 14 days to 35 days prior to the arbitration hearing for public employee collective bargaining, and there are no amendments before you.
Okay, fine. We have two people signed up, Scott Winkles and Mary Botkin.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I'm appearing in favor, representing the League of Oregon Cities. I'm appearing in favor of this legislation. I had arranged to have a expert, Diana Moffitt, the Local Government Personnel Institute Executive Director, testify. Unfortunately, I received a phone call this morning that she had injured herself quite badly last night and was not able to be here. Some farming accident. I'll do my best. This has been a kind of an interesting bill, an interesting conversation for us because we've been hearing from some other of our friends in the management side of this issue that asking us if we're crazy for seeking a change to the binding arbitration process. If you look at the history of the binding arb decisions lately, because really they've been going towards the employer, and my answer to that question is that we'll probably, but I think we're on sound footing here. What the bill does is it extends the time frame for the submission of the last best offer from 14 to 35 days. And what was the original impetus for this bill was that there were a few instances where the sides were coming to the table and they submitted their last best offers, and both sides looked at it and they said, we're not that far apart, and they worked it out. They didn't go to binding arb. And so that I think that was a good conclusion. If you don't have to go to that binding arb process, that I think everybody agrees that that's the better way to do things. Unfortunately, the arbitrator's deadlines are 30 days out. And so they ended up paying the fees to the arbitrator, even though they didn't actually need to use that service. And so what this bill does is it gives the parties 5 days to submit their last best offer. That's their walkaway price, their walkaway offer, their baseline utility from both sides. And it gives them 5 days before they're into that 30-day deadline scenario so that they do have an opportunity to work it out. And I think it also encourages sides to get to that last best offer position sooner in the process. Which I think is better. I mean, we say we're at impasse, but the reality is that you don't submit your last best offer until you've picked arbitrators, until you've gone through this process. And so we think this adds some time and some more opportunities to reach a mutually beneficial conclusion to these issues. And with that, I will conclude and turn it over to my dear friend, Mary Bodkin.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Mary Bodkin, AFSCME, Council 75. I had not intended on testifying on this bill this morning, and I have been madly texting to find out if we have a position. And I was just told by our director, Ken Allen, that he has concerns that this will drag out the process. It is my firm belief that if you give us a day or two, we may be able to resolve any differences between the cities and ourselves.
Okay. Thank you very much. Do we have any questions of the panelists? Mr. Barton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Winkles, I have a hunch I speak for everyone on the committee, and please wish your colleague well for us. Sorry she couldn't join us today, but please send her our best.
Chair Doherty, Representative Barton, I will do so. Thank you.
And second, let me just say, even though we don't seem there yet, I'm just thrilled. I honestly didn't know there was a PECPA issue that wouldn't just light the room on fire. This is unbelievable. Thrilling stuff.
That is a nice surprise.
Well, I think what a lot of people don't realize is when you've got an arbitrator and you've got the arbitration that's 30 days out, if you cancel, you have to pay a cancellation fee, and it can be quite hefty depending on what the issues are. So a lot of this is not only the idea of getting together and getting an agreement, but also saving some both sides a little money.
Rep. Doherty, if I may, to Representative Martin's point, actually one of the more contentious issues in PECPA right now is we're trying to find ways to actually give the Employment Relations Board money. Yes. So we, and I think we also agree on that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and your point about arbitration is well made. One of the key components of collective bargaining, I think, is that you have to be there in good faith. And if this extends that, great, but if it just prolongs perhaps bad faith agreements moving forward, then that's not going to work for anybody either. So I just think that ultimately, oftentimes, it comes down to, on the labor side, you have decision makers that are elected to be in the room to make that decision. On the other side of the table, you have some good folks from management that aren't allowed to make that decision at the point in time, and that can bog the process down. But I've seen some pretty great process has taken place lately, and in fact, City Manager Eric Conversin with Gresham sat down with the firefighters directly and worked out agreements. I think people are getting there to understand that. But thanks for bringing that forward. Look forward to figuring out what you guys can work out. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I'd also like to change instead of last best offer, because coming out of the labor end is we used to call it the last ickiest offer. You know, when we got down to the end, but we were able to come together and always get agreements. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, I close the public hearing on House Bill 2847 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2545.
Madam Chair and committee members, this bill permits the Labor Commissioner to debar from public works contract any contractor or subcontractor that's limited liability company if prevailing wage rate is not paid or posted, if contractor's employees are not paid when the contractor pays employees on the subcontractor's behalf, or if information is falsified on a certified statement. Declares an emergency effective on passage, and there are no amendments.
Yeah, fine. We have one person signed up. Oh, we have two people signed up. Representative Holvey.
This is 2545.
And Elizabeth Kushwa.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members, State Representative Paul Holt, for the record, House District 8. Thanks for hearing this bill. I'm bringing this bill forward. I'm thinking it being a pretty simple bill, really just adding limited liability companies to the list of corporations, partnerships that are subject to debarment by BOLI if they, you know, do some of the things that are listed currently under law. I know there's perhaps, I've heard, I don't really know for sure, but I've heard there might be concern that we're trying to drag in members of these organizations who may not have been responsible for the violation or that. And the bill's, I don't think, intended to do that. It's about the members who are responsible. I think in the construction contracting world, they call them responsible managing individuals. So I just want to make that clear that, you know, we're not debarring all the members of an LLC or corporation or trying to if they didn't have anything to do with the violation. I think that's sort of the intent of the proposal, and if that isn't really spelled out clearly in the bill, I'm happy to work with people who have that concern. I think it's spelled out in the bill, but it may not be clear enough for some. So I think otherwise this is a relatively easy bill and sort of a, I won't call it a cleanup, but a catch-up, you know, to bring LLCs into the realm of the laws, because as you know, LLCs came into existence after these statutes were put together, so they weren't included, and I believe they should be included now. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Kushwa.
Good morning again, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Kushwa with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Let me give you a little bit of background on this bill. In 2003, the legislature enacted this bill relating to ineligibility for public works contractors, debarment, for contractors who intentionally violated provisions of the prevailing wage rate law. The law was drafted, actually stated, when the contractor or subcontractor is a corporation, debarment provisions apply to any corporate officer or corporate agent who is responsible for the violations of prevailing wage rates law. The statute does not similarly apply to limited liability companies. This really is fixing a loophole. Bully feels strongly about the education and compliance portion of PWR law. This only applies to those who intentionally violate prevailing wage rate law, such as refusal to pay prevailing wage or intentionally falsifying payrolls in public works projects that are subject to prevailing wage rate. I have a terrible time saying that. And so we believe that extending the debarment to those LLC members it makes a whole lot of sense. I heard a story just a couple of days ago, and I don't want to actually bring up the names of the company, although we can talk about it offline if you'd like. There was a roofing company where the person was debarred as an LLC, closed down, opened up under a new name. No penalty for any of this, and it seems highly improper that someone can do that, close down, open up, change names, and escape this loophole with LLCs. So it actually is unfair to other businesses who are behaving appropriately, and we think this just closes that loophole for LLCs.
Okay, fine, thank you. Any questions of the panelists? Okay, seeing none. These were the only two we had signed up. Is there anybody else who would like to speak on this issue? Okay, seeing none, I close the the public hearing on House Bill 2545. And we'll just stand at ease for a couple of minutes. Representative Barnhart's on his way. to open up the hearing on House Bill 2379. Jan, if you could summarize.
Madam Chair, committee members, this bill prohibits a person who issues debit or credit card or serves as a payment card network from restricting or prohibiting the merchant from disclosing fees paid to the card issuer or the network, from prohibiting them from specifying minimum transaction amount, or from offering discount to the consumer for using a different payment method. Provides that the violation is an unlawful practice and declares an emergency effective on passage. And there are no amendments.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Phil Barnhart. I represent House District 11 in the House. I appreciate the committee's willingness to hear this bill. It came about, I think, as a result of conversations I've had with a number of merchants and my own observations that between the credit card marketing practice of offering discounts over the period of a billing of several billing cycles, and the obvious cost to merchants of actually processing those bills, I think a lot of customers simply don't realize that when they collect a rebate at the end of a billing period, or as a part of a rebate function of some kind, what they're actually doing is increasing merchant fees, which increase the prices of products in order to get that benefit. Also, I think that many customers are simply unaware that the charges for credit cards are built into the pricing structure. So as we drafted this bill, we were trying to think about, okay, how would we do this in a way that would increase the transparency of the transactions that are involved in credit cards, and also allow for the merchant and the customer to make an instant agreement to do something different rather than using the credit card. For example, paying cash for a discount or things of that sort. Now, I had a visit a few days ago from a member of the staff of the Oregon Treasury pointing out that the Dodd-Frank bill from 2010 already regulates a number of these things in ways that I was unaware of until just a couple of days ago. I raised the issue with legislative counsel and realized that as this bill is drafted, it probably conflicts with a number of the provisions of the Dodd-Frank bill that already has the effects of some of the things that we want to do. For example, the Dodd-Frank bill allows provisions that prohibit credit card issuers and payment networks from forbidding merchants to set a minimum transaction amount lower than $10 and from offering cash discounts. So merchants can already do that is in this bill. The one thing that appears not to be in the Dodd-Frank bill that is in this bill is the allowance for the merchant to disclose the amount of the fee that's being charged by the credit card company or the network. And what I'm proposing is that I get an amendment drafted to this bill. I just received the note today or yesterday from alleged counsel when we raised this question with them, that would significantly reduce the scope of the bill because it doesn't need to deal with the things that Dodd-Frank already does and which the federal government has preempted us from doing. But there are a couple of things, mainly the transparency pieces, allowing the merchant to say to you, oh, you want to use an American Express card, it costs this much. Oh, you want to use a Visa card, it costs me that much. Why don't we split the fee and I'll give you a cash discount if you pay in cash. And they could do that by signage and a variety of other things. There are some merchants who would consider that simply too complicated. There are others, I think, who would use it. The way we would manage that kind of thing is that we would prohibit the new contracts from requiring that they not announce what the fees are to the public, and that renewal contracts also not announce that. That way we avoid the Tenth Amendment problem of impairment of contracts issue. So with the committee's indulgence on that issue, I don't think the bill as it stands can be adopted in a way that doesn't conflict with the federal law. But I would like to have the opportunity to bring back an amendment that will do what state law can do and that increases transparency so that people who use their credit cards or their debit cards to make purchases will know what the actual costs are that are being imposed.
Okay. Fine. Do you have any questions of Representative Barnhart? Representative Thatcher?
No, just a comment. I think it'd be interesting to post how much taxes are also being go into the cost of an item. But yeah, just
are you proposing
separate
an
thing.
Amendment?
Right.
Okay, fine, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Okay, the next panel to sign up is Tim Martinez, Betsy Steinberg, and Daryl Younger.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, back before you again, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. I'm joined today by Betsy Steinberg and Daryl Young, both with Pioneer Trust Bank down the street. Pioneer is about a $325 million community bank that has chosen to be chartered as a national bank. So when you talk about national banks and like J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of America and Wells Fargo, you're also talking about Pioneer Trust Bank, $325 million in Salem. They are the experts. They can certainly answer any questions. And I apologize to the committee and to the sponsor of the bill. We've not had a chance to talk to him yet. We will certainly do so. We appreciate the fact that he is willing to basically eliminate most of the bill, that it has been taken care of either through the Dodd-Frank and specifically the Durbin Amendment at the federal level, as well as the settlement, the judicial settlement, which was just reached last year with Visa and MasterCard with the merchants and then went into effect earlier this year in January. I'm not sure the exact date. But I would say, and again, we will be talking to the sponsor, the best that we're aware of, there are no contracts that prohibit disclosure of fees, and that's for 70 years of credit cards. So there isn't anything in the contract that prohibits that disclosure. I will tell you that between the major card networks, there are literally hundreds of exchange categories, which frankly are available on the issuer or on Visa and MasterCard's websites, and that there are more than one factor that go into the pricing of interchange. Card type, network are also part of it, but how and when the merchant processes the transaction also affects when that what that amount is going to be. And it's basically going to be, until the transaction is fully accepted and processed, the merchant's not going to have any idea what that final amount is for that specific transaction. So we, frankly, I'm not here to speak for the merchants, but it would be very difficult for them to do that on an individual basis. But again, there's no prohibition from what the sponsor of the bill would like to do. If they want to negotiate that and have the customer pay for part of it, that's there. There is also federal law that allows for discounting for cash or checks, and those are protected by criminal penalties. So there's, again, I think this bill has been introduced a couple of sessions, and before Durbin, before the settlement, most of the things in here would warrant discussion at the state level, but I think they've now been pretty much resolved. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or turn it over to my experts.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
This is Betsy Steinberg. I'm from Pioneer Trust Bank, and actually Tim did a very good recap of what we were going to testify, which pretty much is unnecessary at this point, but I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. Moving forward, as he mentioned, we have a full bank card program. We issue not only debit cards, credit cards, consumer and business, but we're unique in that we do a merchant acquiring program, that we do merchant processing, and we do the pricing ourselves. And to give you an idea of the interchange rates, this is the MasterCard tables.
Oh, my heavens.
For the and you've got Visa and Discover and American Express that we have to account into our pricing for our merchants. So again, because we do know all both sides of the transaction, we would be happy to make ourselves available going forward.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Young, anything to add? Or? Okay, thank you. Any questions of the panel? Representative Holby?
No, thank you, and thank you for that. I seem to remember this bill from the past and then remembered now that it came back that Dodd-Frank really addressed a lot of these issues. But I'm sort of curious just about the range of fees. I mean, you know, having a fee for an interchange, it seems like it'd be a simple, flat little fee, and you've got a stack of paper that looks like it's 100 pages thick.
It is.
And, you know, and so I'm curious, you know, I think you bring up a good point. How is the merchant going to disclose what that fee is? If he wanted to, even. But is there a way for the merchant to, there's got to be a way for the merchant to know kind of a range of what that fee is likely to be, I would think. Or they just are totally in the dark of what the fee is going to be at the end of the month?
Depending on the pricing structure that their acquirer sets, because they don't pay the interchange directly to the networks. They actually, they pay a price that's determined by their processor. So there, again, that's not even the same rate that's in this table. It's a different rate. It includes their processing fees for handling that transaction as well. So it depends on the pricing model. Some pricing models are very simplistic. Some are what they call component, where they take each interchange and just do a little bump up. And so it's not a simple answer. Again, I wish it were. Maybe Daryl can answer.
Yes, Representative, hopefully.
If you could identify yourself.
Yeah, I'm Daryl Young from Pioneer Trust Bank, the compliance officer there. And actually, Visa and MasterCard both, due to the recent settlement that they have where they are allowing merchants to surcharge for credit card transactions based upon the discount rate that they pay, have published tables of average rates that the merchants can use depending on the type of merchant they are. It isn't exactly, you know, a exact amount that they're paying on that particular transaction, but as part of the settlement they did publish some average rates that they can use for that.
Okay, great. That answers my question. Thanks.
Any other questions? Okay, seeing none. Thank you very much. We have nobody else signed up. Do we have anybody else who would like to speak on this issue? Okay, so hearing none, I close the public hearing on House Bill 2379. And open the work session on 2383. Could go through what?
Yes, Madam Chair, committee members, this bill prohibits the merchant from requiring the consumer to present a statement of account in order to obtain a refund of payment for card transaction. It permits the Attorney General or the District Attorney to bring action against the merchant and obtain a civil penalty up to $1,000 per violation. And it permits the court to award attorney fees to the prevailing party.
Would you like to call in Representative Barnhart? I didn't realize he had left the room.
He came. He'll be right back. I can begin, though. Chair okay. Doherty, committee members, for the record, my name is Sonia Carlson, and I'm Representative Barnhart's Chief of Staff. We bring you House Bill 2383 because of my own personal experience with two different companies. In each instance, a bank or credit card statement was requested in order to provide a refund. In the first instance, I had contacted the company because they had incorrectly charged my account twice for their monthly service. Their account representative told me that the only way they could provide me a refund would be for me to fax my credit card statement to a number that this person would give me. I had two gut reactions to this request. First, my private credit card transactions would become public. Second, I couldn't confirm that the fax number was actually associated with that company. After numerous conversations with other account representatives and finally a manager, I was able to get them to review their own financial records and provide me with a refund. But I couldn't help think that this practice proposed a financial security risk for many other customers who did not want to spend countless hours going through the same process that I had. Within a few months of this first incident, I was doing volunteer work for an organization that had also received a duplicate charges on their account.
Okay. So can I stop you just for a minute? Apparently I opened this as a work session and this is a public hearing, so I would like to close the work session on House Bill 2383
since
and
it
open
was
the
on
public
that.
Hearing on House Bill 2383.
Thank you. Do I need to restate my name for the record? Okay. This company was given access to automatically deduct the cost of their services from this organization's bank account. And when I called the company to request the refund, I got the same response. You need to fax us or send us by mail a physical copy of your bank statement that shows the two transactions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Phil Barnhart, State Representative, House District 11. You've already heard the gist of why I brought this bill. It seemed quite bizarre to me that a company that has its own records of transactions like this would ask for information which contains other very personal data on the part of an individual, or certainly data that they have no right to on the part of an organization. The fact that it happened twice to one person suggests to me that this is an issue that should be dealt with. My chief of staff is a very assertive person, as you can hear, and she managed to avoid this. But my suspicion is that others would have simply sent the information, foregone the privacy law, put up with the privacy loss, for no good reason that I can understand at all. Hence the advent of this bill.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Are there any questions of the panel?
Just maybe a real quick comment. I'm actually experiencing that exact same thing at this moment in time.
With a different merchant, of course.
Very interesting.
Very interesting.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Another comment. I also have experienced this once before. I have to admit, I had a different take, though. Maybe it's because I'm a open person and don't have profound sense of privacy. That's, I suppose, many of us who run for office feel that way. But I simply redacted my credit card statement so that it only showed the two relevant transactions. Redacted and sent it in, and immediately got a refund. It was not that challenging of a process, but a different approach.
And they accepted that.
Yeah.
If I may, Madam Chair, Representative Barton. I think that's another way of being assertive. Mm-hmm. My suspicion is that other people have sent in what they were asked for, which was a copy, without the redaction. And I think that's absolutely inappropriate. I have a great difficulty understanding why any business that has its own business records would need any such thing. They should be able to refer back to their own business records to determine whether they made an error or not, whether they agree with the customer that they made an error or not, without asking the customer for additional a confirmation up front. Now, if they couldn't find an error later, then asking for some kind of way of confirming that might make some reason sense. But at that point, what they should ask for is a redacted statement.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else to speak on this bill? Okay, seeing none, I close the public hearing. Usually our last bill we do a work session. The public hearing on House Bill 2383. Okay, we have no other business before us, but I do want to remind you that have a good weekend, and on Monday we are beginning at 8 a.m.
Oh. Nice one. That was good.
Very busy. Okay, thank you very much for your patience this week.